there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today, I'm over at Georgetown University speaking with Jacques Berlinerblau. He is professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service here at Georgetown. His work has appeared in many places. He really is, in that overused term, a public intellectual, as well as a genuine scholar. You know, I was looking at your CV, and how many languages do you have? Five?
Yeah, a lot.
Okay,
yeah,
okay, good, good.
Some have gotten a little rusty, but for the most part, yeah, they're there.
He writes often in the Washington Post, The Nation magazine, Chronicle of Higher Education, and have numerous TV appearances as well. His previous book was How to Be Secular, but today we're going to talk about a book that came out last year about the campus. It's called Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Welcome, Jacques.
Hi, Mark. I'm so happy to be here today
with you. Thank you. Thank you for...
happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Well, we're going to get right in because I read this early on, and there's a lot of talk about higher education. It has been for several years. But I have to say that when I read this, we get perspectives and details about elements of campus life and faculty life that often go unreported, unnoticed, in some of the more... you know, easy, controversial topics such as the tuition, such as political correctness, and so on. And what I want to do is begin by simply reading for our listeners the opening couple of paragraphs, and then turn it over to you, and let you reflect upon this. And it'll give the flavor of the book, which I don't usually... endorse or support a book directly so much, but I think I want people to hear the voice that comes through in this. This is from the introduction. The title is "The Lanyards of Despair." Lanyards, the name tags people wear around their necks at these academic meetings. I'm a full professor who teaches at a prestigious, almost flouncy, R1 university. Even though I was tenured 15 years ago, no pretentious assistant professor can call me Deadwood yet. That's because I still churn out peer-reviewed research with a serene joylessness that would stagger a Trappist monk. Nice, nice. I test-run the articles and chapters in my pipeline when I deliver working papers at academic conferences. These take place in stadium-sized conference centers located in American cities I would otherwise never visit. During my allotted quarter hour of speaking time, I relay to my audience, seven people, the fruits of roughly 1,200 hours of research. This will be followed by a five-minute Q&A session in which someone's trailing spouse delivers a six-minute manifesto. How often in the Q&A do you not get any cue? Many lectures in response. More A than Q. His oration appears to be completely unrelated to the content of my remarks. I daze shamble out of my panel alongside a throng of contingent and non-contingent faculty. We are all looking for meeting halls in which other incomprehensible, poorly attended talks are about to begin. Some of these rooms are named after the state flower or a deceased governor. To an outside observer, our frenzied movements in search of Iris 6 or Blanton 8 must resemble the murmuration of starlings. To an insider, however, these academic get-togethers could be likened to a vast debris field, tragically strewn with thousands of financially struggling doctorates. These scholars have labored for 10, 20, 30 years and still no gainful employment. Their lanyards lie askew upon their breasts. Their name badges, like mine, could just as well read, "How the hell did it come to this?" Okay. How did it come to this? That's the book.
How did it come to this?
I mean, one way we could begin by saying everything in a humanities PhDs or academic PhDs formation, the training you receive, really conspires against the kind of wit and ironic observation that you provide in this opening. Maybe I'll ask you to be a little biographical here. What do you think has given you the ability to look down upon the comedy of human academics with this kind of perspective?
That's such a good question. How did I break out, right? How did I break out of the mold? This is so funny. I always felt that the types of people in our generation, Mark, who went to graduate school in the humanities were already freaks and geeks. We were weird. We didn't want to make a tremendous amount of money, right? We weren't cloyingly political. We just wanted to study obscure things. That's the best I can make of it, right? What happened, though, is the process in graduate school somehow created a uniformity of psychological depravity or psychological problems, right? It seemed to bring out in people the same dysfunction, and for whatever reasons, it brought out different dysfunctions in me than it did in other folks, right? So it made me kind of belligerent, it made me opinionated, it made me want to get into the middle of things, it made me want to actually listen to other people. So maybe I had a bad experience, but the bad experience pushed me in a very, very different direction, or maybe I'm just a weirdo, one of the two.
What were the elements of graduate school that would produce that uniformity?
Right. So they were ideological and they were, shall we say, scheduling or personal or professional. On the professional, there is just the solitude of working in the humanities, the hours and hours and hours of just being alone. You've been through this. I've been through this. We grew up in the day of copying machines. Remember those? I remember having an intimate relationship with a copying machine. I mean, I'd be pressed up against it. It would be warm, and I would be kind of printing out all these articles that I needed, right? Because the idea was that everything must be read. In our day, right, when you wrote a dissertation,
you got to read everything.
Everything in every language, right? Which is actually a good ethos, I think. I have no problem with it. But it inspires a certain type of madness, and it does not conduce to the development of your interpersonal skills nor your emotional intelligence when your paramour is a Xerox copying machine. That doesn't make one more adroit in their dealings with others.
Right.
In terms of the political, what was going on when I was in graduate school in the 90s, and I did two tours of duty, right, I was in two different graduate school settings, is French theory, postmodernism, post-structuralism, post-colonialism had already washed ashore, but now it was a tsunami. And when I was, for example, the New School for Social Research, at that moment in the early 90s, everything was funneled through the French political philosopher Michel Foucault, who I find very interesting, by the way. I never had a problem reading Foucault, right? I had a problem with the pervasiveness of Foucauldian worldview in my education.
You know, I remember reading a line out of Eve Sedgwick's book, her second book that won a big award at the MLA, where she says in the introduction to that book, Epistemology of the Closet, as Foucault... according to Michel Foucault, whose statements I consider axiomatic.
Right.
Axiomatic, something as speculative and far-reaching as Foucault is axiomatic. Wait a minute. Right. I thought you guys were all about dissent, you know, carving out the space for the other, and you're taking this as axiomatic. Wow.
There was something just very, very peculiar, even creepy, about the reception of Foucault in these American graduate programs in the interpretive social sciences and in the humanities. I want to stress, I think we've had this discussion over drinks, you know, I like Foucault. I mean, I've read stuff, I'm like, wow, that's cool.
Have to read it.
You have to read it, right? But I also liked Weber. I also liked Hannah Arendt. I also liked Emile Durkheim. There was a guy, Wilfredo Pareto. I always wanted to read him. I could never get around to this guy when I was studying social theory because there was so much Foucault. So what was happening to me in graduate school was a type of psychological isolation, which all students, I think, deal with. But on top of that, and perhaps you dealt with this as well, I felt very alienated from the materials because I was only getting one type of worldview that was being taught to me, and I was curious about other worldviews.
And you just have the personality that you felt that reliance or that investment in Foucault, you felt that as a coercion.
I felt it
on
as
yourself.
I felt coerced, right? I felt coerced, and I didn't understand why a writer that lush and esoteric, downstream, it always ended up in a variety of very predictable political positions. I could not. I think the guy was more here. This is what I'm trying to say. He was more interesting than his champions, right? I think you could read Foucault in more, like Michael Walzer, I think, once wrote a piece, Michel Foucault, A Young Conservative. You might remember that one. He was saying, well, there's some really conservative stuff here. So that reading of Foucault was just stanched or suppressed, right?
Didn't Foucault insist that everyone needs to read Hayek? I'm trying to remember where he might have said, he might have said that somewhere, but, you know, Foucault found Hayek a fascinating thinker.
Foucault went to Iran during the revolution and was all in, right?
That's
was absolutely all in, and this is something that... So he seems to be a very interesting guy, and maybe I wasn't being allowed to explore what was most interesting about Foucault in some of these graduate courses. But how I kind of zoomed out and could see certain things about a vocation that others would rather that I not see, I can't explain it. Other than, maybe this is it, I didn't marry an academic. Mm-hmm. Most of my friends aren't professors. So maybe this gave me a sort of critical distance, if you will, that I could say, oh, here's another reason. I love campus novels. Right? So I teach courses on campus novels, and I find campus novels do the same thing. Yeah. The folks who write campus novels are like inside outsiders. They're inside, but what makes a good story is not fulsome praise of the institution, right? They rip the institution apart.
Like David Lodge. You know, David Lodge, my first encounter with David Lodge was an anthology of 20th century literary criticism that he edited. He was first a critic, theorist of the novel, before writing a novel. So he's in, inside and outside.
He was a heretic, right? He was an inside outsider, right?
You like The History Man? You mentioned that,
right?
In,
so
in
that's
the novel.
Bradbury, The History Malcolm Man. Bradbury. I like that one a lot. That's it. But Philip Roth, who that's one of my areas of expertise. People don't understand the degree to which half of Philip Roth's novels take place on college campuses.
A lot of campuses.
And there's a lot of dysfunction. Right. You think of The Human Stain, right, with political correctness run amok. Roth is thinking very hard about the college campus. And what is every campus novelist do? Every campus novelist has to show you, when you walk on a college campus, it's a utopia. Right? It's a place of learning.
It's a place
of equality. It's a place where coercion and relations of violence and power and force don't obtain. Right? And every campus novel has to undo that, right? And show you that it's all there. All the human foibles are present on a college campus, regardless of the hypocritical cant that the institution promulgates to the world.
You have an epigraph from Philip Roth, The Human Stain. Do you know Bernard Malamud's book?
A New Life.
A New Life. A New Life. Right. Going out to...
Oregon.
Right. Didn't Malamud go to Oregon State for a time and sort of based it on his...
Jewish guy who only knows the city university system, and he goes out to teach expository writing, I believe, in Oregon. Encounters incredible anti-Semitism. And every stock villain that there is in the academic, like, bestiary... It's really funny.
It is funny. It's good. It's a good read. American going out west.
Going out west.
A new life, right? The pioneers.
And it's like this military industrial complex of English writing instructors, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it is very funny.
Well, now, in the book, you do pick up on very interesting things that take place that really. People who are off campus, you know, you say you're off campus, your non-academic friends gave you perspective on this, but in so many ways, they have no idea what's going on. If they've never been in a committee meeting, if they've never been in a closed-door session with the rest of a department to say to discuss a tenure case, you really have no idea about how that works. And, you know, I want to refer to something you mentioned. I don't know if you want to go into much detail about this, but it could get to one example of what really matters to a professor. You say, this is on page 174 of the book, I still bear the psychic scars of a particularly vicious conflict waged between the Romance languages and comparative literature departments a long time ago. And one thing you notice, in you certainly have office politics right. in the corporate world, mm-hmm. but you don't have one silo going to war against another silo,
right.
whereas in college campuses, a whole department will wage war against yeah. another department.
Yeah,
and
right.
I don't know if you want to go into this, but
sure,
you say that battle irrevocably altered about a dozen academic careers. A small platoon of contingent faculty was road-killed. About 50 other faculty members from other units were sucked into the combat and could not attend their professional duties. Lawsuits. Almost a few fistfights.
Right.
Anyway.
It really is funny. We've all been in those meetings, right? And again, in terms of, we think of the campus novel, it's the same idea that you think it's really intelligent folks sitting around a table and consulting and listening and dialoguing, and we tend to fall back on all the stereotypes that the campus novelists associate with. I want to go back to something else you asked, because I'm really thinking about it.
Okay.
Why did I break out? I had a career, and I imagine it might be the same with you, I had a career as a failed jazz musician. So the world
really?
That I was in graduate school, in the evening I was playing jazz, I was playing at nightclubs, and I wasn't playing well. I want to be
what
very,
were you
very clear. I was playing the vibraphone, jazz vibraphone,
really?
Which is a very peculiar instrument. So I always felt closer to that world where people are brutally honest, and where on a stage
That's
you will
right.
get sliced up, as I often was, if you are not
if you
ready
don't cut
to play.
It.
If you don't cut it, you get cut, right?
And
what they call it.
Right? A deep knowledge of tradition,
right.
on those people, you know, and in terms of you got to have your repertoire,
right.
you got you know you play the trumpet, you better have your sense of Dizzy Gillespie and
right.
And
you need
all,
to know
all the rest.
50 solos that you've
That's
memorized
right.
and transpose them into all 12 keys. So that experience of being around really good artists, I would say, right, who were telling me I was a really bad artist, which was important, and telling me rather vociferously and consistently was very important. But it made me think about our art form,
right,
as
right,
professors,
right, right.
and how we weren't obeying the same protocols, how we didn't have the same standards, how we weren't concentrating on really what made a professor good or not. We were concentrating on politics. We were concentrating on networks.
And John, one thing about those musicians, it's the music that matters. Not who you know.
Like
when you get on stage,
yeah.
you're networking. Your identity, whatever, nothing
There's
matters
no
except
politics
the music.
There.
Nope, the politics is suspended.
I mean, it might be certain club owners don't like certain musicians or won't work with certain, but the politics are muted to the point where it really is just about what you do when you play
right.
with other musicians. And I always thought the Academy would be that, but it wasn't.
So what is the parallel for someone in your work? It would be the content and the delivery of your lectures,
right.
of your teaching, your
right.
classroom.
Right.
It would be the your writing, the quality
exactly.
of your research.
It would be the quality of your writing and your research, which would be inextricably bound with your teaching performance with your students, and there'd be an organic whole. It would be a very organic experience to be my ideal type of professor, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you worked on and what you read would loop back into what you did in the classroom and what your students taught you when you spoke to them about the literature that you were working on would then loop back into your writing, which has happened many times to me.
And I think that was, to a great extent, the old model when someone would work on a dissertation and, you know, in the 1950s, and it might then get published as a monograph, and then another book wouldn't appear for 10 or 12 years, and the professor was working things through in the classroom. Ideas about literature,
right.
about literary history, and so on. I mean you're in a different department, but I mean the same way this productivity model, what you say in the opening here, constantly working on churning things out. You don't have time to sort of pause, work things through in classroom presentations, teaching different kinds of courses, and letting your ideas mature through that process.
Right.
Gone.
Right. That is gone. That cadence, that clip of really thinking through. I mean, when I think of some of the classic works of literary theory that I read from the 40s and 50s, they seem so much more considered and heavy. Right? There's a heaviness about them that you feel that every paragraph
right,
was a week
right,
or
right,
two,
right?
Not a day, right? Like
right.
a week or two of intense
Eric Auerbach's, you know, right. studies no, come right. out of years of teaching those
right.
works.
Right, right,
I
right.
think.
Who's the seven types of ambiguity? Is that
That's Empson.
Empson.
William
right?
Empson.
You read that, you're like, wow, this guy's really quite intelligent. Or when you read right. New Critics, right, you have a sense of a different types of craftsmanship and attention to every aspect, from how the prose reads
right,
to
right,
the bibliographical depth of the claims, right, to right. a knowledge of what's going on in France and Germany. And we've lost that. But here's one other right. thing. We're not like... Jazz musicians can make people smile in a way that many professors can't. And I've always wondered if we should think of ourselves... This is going to be high heresy, but it's neither a heresy of the left or the right. So I'm going to throw it out there. You can squash it down mercilessly if you want. Should we think of ourselves more as entertainers? Right? As people that take ideas and make them interesting and get people interested in ideas?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing is that if you're going to be pushing the humanities, it's got to be exhilarating.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
I mean, why else do it if it doesn't have inspiration, joy, humor? If students never laugh in a humanities right. class, there's something
that's
wrong.
A really bad sign,
that's a bad sign.
Which they don't anymore.
And, right, well, know. I think, I mean, a lot of my colleagues have part of the politics is you start getting humorless about things. I mean, there should be a little antic feature. I mean, how can you teach Byron's Don Juan without all the jokes and without people laughing in all of that? But also you tell them, look, what you're going to get in this class is the greatest stuff.
Right.
Okay, this is the best material.
Right.
And you're going to love it. Yeah. You got to love it. This is what we have. We have to tell them. And too many classes are a downer.
So
right? Too many classes are just filled with negativity.
Yeah, negativity and the channeling of collective rage. In my yes. class, you know, I'm all big on active learning. I talk a lot about active learning. But what I try to do with my students in my freshman ProSem is I tell them, this is going to be the best conversation you're going to have today. All right? So I see my job a little differently there than I would in a class. I see myself as like, my son plays upright jazz bass as we go back to jazz. And what I've realized about a jazz bassist is you kind of have to adapt really fast to a lot of people doing things that maybe you wish they wouldn't be doing, right? But that's what these guys underneath it all have to do, right? They're supporting other artists going off in every imaginable direction.
Right.
So the jazz bassist is subtly maneuvering the discussion if she or he does this very, very well. So I always think of myself in these classes as, here we're reading, yesterday we were reading a Jhumpa Lahiri story, which I like very, The Third and Final Continent, which is a really cool story, right? And the week before that, an Adichie story from The Thing Around Your Neck, right? So class discuss, but my job as a professor is to have so mastered that story, and I know every inch of the story, is to sort of push them to the more provocative, the more fascinating, the more nuanced, and the more textured readings that the author probably had in mind. Then we can get to the ones that the author probably didn't have in mind. So it's a new way of thinking about teaching. It doesn't have to be about Berliner Blau, the professor. It's Berliner Blau secretly goading them, all right, almost subconsciously, to find their most interesting and analytical selves in that classroom.
The emphasis seems increasingly to fall not on that interaction. For instance, you have a sequence in the book where you talk about the campus tour, right? That 21-year-old walking backwards and pointing out all different kinds of things. You say, hey, Warren Harding gave a lecture from these steps 80 or 100 years ago. This happened, and you know the physics lab is all or the business school
the
is all
Kinoa
sustainable
cafeteria,
everything. Like that. And you say, but ultimately, here, this is you, but ultimately, nothing will validate the massive investment of time and money that is a college education more than a student's encounter with professors. I am speaking of those roughly 1,800 contact hours spent in the company of 30 to 40 teachers. That's the core. It's not the climbing wall, nor is it the professor's research. If that research doesn't carry back into the dynamic, teacher and student. Why'd we lose that?
Well, I don't know.
Or why is that underemphasized, I should say?
In terms of our own culpability, I think we misunderstood what the AAUP was telling us in that 1940 manifesto of theirs. I don't think the AAUP was saying there is a good for the scholar and its tenure. And
the AAUP is the American Association of University Professors.
Right? And they created this tenure system after many fits and starts. And I think their idea was it's good for a professor to feel that she will not be sacked and sent off to a foreign country for saying something that upsets a trustee, which is a great principle, right? They didn't tell us how you earn that privilege. They didn't properly calibrate or identify, maybe this was a good thing, whether it would be research or teaching or some very, very textured combination of the two. And what I think happened at the research universities, in particular the more prestigious ones, is it became research output, and now it's become these Google Scholar citations and things that are measurable. And we're culpable.
Measurable.
Right. Measurable.
So on my annual report, probably on yours, you don't have any square, any box in which to write down how many hours you spent talking with students outside of class.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. It doesn't exist.
It doesn't. Right? It doesn't. So why do it? Right. It's not going to help you. It's not going to improve your salary. It's not going to help get you promoted. Whereas being by yourself writing that peer-reviewed article, that goes down on the report.
Everything is upside down, and we go back to these campus novels, and I'm thinking it's one of these lodge texts where there's a guy actually standing upside down. Do you remember the scene? He's on this weird elevator, which was at this university in England. There was one of the first elevators, and there's a guy standing upside, he's on his hands upside down, and I believe that was Lodge's way of pointing out to how everything is completely inverted in terms of our value system. I don't know what can be done.
The admissions office and the college marketing office want to emphasize how much contact time you'll have with the professors, but the professors have exactly the opposite incentive.
Right. But that professor who will actually spend the contact hours is an underpaid, poorly treated NTFTL, that's non-tenure full-time or an adjunct, with no academic freedom protection. So how upside down is it, right? They're spending the bulk of the time with the undergrads, right? Whereas the tenured folks, such as ourselves, get to spend time with the graduate students, but I'm sworn off teaching graduate students.
So have I.
So it's just all wrong, and it's so incredibly depressing, Mark, and I don't know how we extricate ourselves from this situation. I feel we're just like slouching downwards and slouching down. We're both, we're not getting any younger, you and I, and nobody listens to us anyhow. So so now what?
Well, I actually believe, you know, at Emory a few years ago, I ran a program and got some outside money for it. And one of the things that I did was pay senior professors to develop new freshman courses.
Oh, that's great.
And they loved it. Getting back into the working with 19-year-olds, working these advanced professors, going to conferences, talking to other advanced professors, getting back into the classroom and teaching the students who were 3 months out of high school. Right. So sometimes remember, freshmen were in high school 3 months earlier.
Exactly.
Getting them, they actually found it invigorating.
I like that so much. You have to like why do people become professors if they don't like working with 18 to 22-year-olds? That's the group you're working with, right? You better like that age group because you're going to be dealing with them for 50 years if you get tenure.
I criticize them, I'm tough on them, and I can tell you exert very strong intellectual standards, but you like them.
Yeah.
You have to like them, and they sense if you don't like them.
Yeah.
You know, that you can't stand at a podium for 14 weeks without showing them what you really think of them deep down.
Right. Right. What you're saying is it's kind of like what's strange about the experience of reading a novel, right? What's weird about reading a novel compared to other art forms is it's just your mind and that writer's mind for 12 hours.
Right.
It's such an intimate form of aesthetic encounter, right? It's you and this writer, like hand to hand, right? Which is unfortunately not working well for us in the type of social media landscape that we're in right now. So literature really has a challenge. What's weird about being a professor, right? For what, it's like 46 hours or something like that? For about 46 hours, right?
You're there,
right? Just speaking to a bunch of 19-year-old kids and the capacity to change their worldview is actually very, very significant. Sure, some kids are tuned out.
It is.
Sure, some kids are total ding-dongs, right? But there are a bunch of kids there that if you say something really, really interesting, it will, like train tracks that Weber spoke about, it's like a switchman, right? All of a sudden, that train that was headed to become a consultant for all of a sudden moves to art history, right? Or all of a sudden moves to the study of the human genome or whatever it might be. And that's the unique power that professors possess. That's our potential. But I feel that we're not really actualizing our potential.
One wonders if the decline of the humanities, you mentioned this here, just the loss of enrollments, is going to reach a point in history and English, which is just in the last 10 years, a steep decline. Will it reach a point at which enough professors realize that if we don't alter the way we engage with students, they're going to keep leaving? And we don't have anything else really to offer them in terms of immediate career. I mean, you study psychologist, you become a psychologist. You study chemistry, you become a chemist. You study English, you don't become an Englishist.
Right.
There's no, so it has to be something between the interaction itself that's going to affect them. We can't point to other things that they, like, we're not pre-med. So are we going to reach a critical point at which you say, look, we got to stop thinking so much about producing more articles that nobody reads?
I feel we do not have the requisite leadership and will to affect this change. So I'm extremely pessimistic about this, Mark. I'm really pessimistic that things can be changed. And, you know, we're reading Candide, we're reading Voltaire's Candide. And it ends off with the idea that you must cultivate your own garden.
That's it.
And this is what I think for people like us, you know, I take my 15 students and my ProSem very seriously. Next semester, my Philip Roth class, my Blacks and Jews class, I'm there for them. I'm going to be prepared for each lecture. I'm going to have great notes. I'm going to write letters of recommendation I'm going to mentor. And what else can I do to address this problem? That's it. I cultivate my own garden. Cultivez votre jardin.
Oui. Let me say again, the book is Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. You can look it up on Amazon, although I prefer that you not use Amazon. You go to Melville House, which is the publisher, or go through some your local bookstore, even better, to get the book. It's a great read. And I want to thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for joining us. This was so fun. And we talked about jazz bass and we talked about jazz, so it's all good.
Very good.